today is the 17th of Tammuz. It's the fast day, the beginning of the 3 weeks of mourning. And I want to give an intro today to the period we're about to embark upon, the next 3 weeks, culminating with Tisha B'Av. And also give a little bit of perspective on the actual fast that we're having today. And hopefully, if we have time, we'll begin going through the book of Eicha, the Megillah that we read on Tisha B'Av, the book of Lamentations. So we'll see if we have time to get to that also today. But we'll take it piece by piece. And the truth is, today should be the happiest day on the Jewish calendar. Why? Because what happened? Moshe went up to Mount Sinai to get the Torah on Shavuos. 40 days later, he was supposed to return with the first set of tablets. And that would have been really the culmination of the giving of the Torah. That would have been the day of the Jewish people becoming the ideal people they should have been. That was the day where the world kind of reaches its perfection. What happened on that day? Instead of the Jews receiving the first tablets and Moshe returning from the mountain, what happened was that they worshipped the golden calf, the Egel HaZahav. And based on the fact they worshipped the golden calf, the tablets are broken, and the world never reached that state of perfection. And to this very day, we're still waiting to get back to the level that the Jews were supposed to reach on the 17th of Tammuz, you know, over 3,000 years ago. Had Moshe come down and the Jews not worshipped the calf, we would have been in a different world today. The rabbis teach us that the first set of tablets had within them much power, that they would have been able to remove from the world death, remove from the world forgetfulness. We would never forget a word of the Torah. We would know everything. It would remove from the world the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. The world would have reached a state of perfection, a state of high, a very high spiritual level. And because the Jews sinned with the golden calf, that was lost. So today is a day which we should have been celebrating, and God willing, very soon we'll be celebrating as a holiday. This will in the future will be a holiday. All the fast days will flip into days of simcha and of joy in the future, as the rabbis teach us. But for now, we're stuck mourning and fasting today, based on events which transpired, beginning with the sin of the golden calf, and many others which we'll talk about in a minute. There's a story which, I don't want to say it's a legend, but it's very hard to find an actual source for this, even amongst Jewish sources. The only source that I could find was actually a source that was much later than the actual event. So I don't know if we can look at it historically or not, but it definitely is quoted in many Jewish sources, later Jewish sources, and it definitely could be true. Either way, it's a powerful story. And it's the most authoritative source I found it in was in the book, it was quoted from the book Torah Sa'ola, written by the Ramar Bush Israelis, who was the halachic authority for Ashkenazi Jewry, written about the 1500s or so. So the story is recorded that a philosopher by the name of Apalton in Hebrew, which seems to be Plato, met with Yirmiyahu HaNavi, Jeremiah the prophet. And this meeting occurred after the destruction of the temple. Jeremiah was the one who witnessed destruction of the temple. He was the one who wrote the book of Eicha, the book of Lamentations. He is the one who was the Jewish prophet during those terrible times. So Apalton, which seems to be Plato meets with Jeremiah the prophet. And both, you know, highly intelligent people, both scholars in their own right. And Plato says, I have two questions for you, Jeremiah. Jeremiah, I have two questions for you. He says, number one, I don't understand, why are you crying over sticks and stones? It was a building. It was simply a building, the temple. It was a nice building. It was an important building. But somebody of your intellectual stature, you're crying over sticks and stones? That's one question he asked. Number two, he asked him, he said, I don't understand that even if you think it's an important building, what's done is done. The past is the past. To cry over spilled milk, we know, is not an intelligent thing. It's over. The Mikdash is gone. The temple is destroyed. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, as they say. It's all over. How can you cry over something which happened in the past? Don't cry over spilled milk. So they go on to discuss different questions of philosophy. They're having conversations. And it's recorded that all the questions that Plato asked, Jeremiah had answers for. And he wowed him with his knowledge, with his scholarship. And Plato said to him again, you know, you're such an intelligent person. I don't understand. Why are you mourning over this building of sticks and stones? Why are you crying over spilled milk? So Yirmiyah responded. He said to Plato, he says, number one, on your first question, the reason that I know so much, the reason that I have so much knowledge, that I'm so sharp, I'm so scholarly, is only because of that building. That building gave me all the knowledge that I have. In other words, the blessing from God that came through that building, the inspiration which came from heaven through the Beis HaMikdash, the high levels we reached through serving God in the Beis HaMikdash, that gave Jeremiah the prophet, that gave Jeremiah the prophet his ability to understand the world. And he says, because of that building, which you're telling me I shouldn't cry over, that's why I know so much. And as for your second question, he says, the question, why am I crying over spilled milk? He says, you're not going to understand it. I can't even explain it to you.
And that's, he's talking to Plato?
He's talking to Plato. He says, you won't get it. You won't understand why I'm crying over something in the past. Now, there's much written over what that line means, because he doesn't explain what he means. When Irma says it to Plato, he doesn't explain what he means by that line. But it's something which all of us struggle to live with also. You know, we don't understand why do we focus so much on the past. We're supposed to focus on the future. We're supposed to look forward to greater times and greater events and not always dwell on history. And in a sense, Plato is right. But Jeremiah says there's a reason that we dwell on the past and you just don't get it. So, again, much is written about that line. I'm not going to spend time discussing what exactly Jeremiah meant. But it's a lesson for us to understand that we have trouble understanding. We are very removed from the Korban, from the destruction. I mean, the destruction of the Second Temple occurred in the year 70 CE, according to our sources, nearly 2,000 years ago. We've been wandering the world ever since as a Jewish people. And we, thank God, are very comfortable nowadays in America. We don't always feel the urge and the reason to mourn. We don't always feel the connection. What am I missing? What do we not have, which we should have? Now, it happens to be, unfortunately, today we see that many Jews are under rocket fire. We have experienced tragedies. We have experienced national tragedies, personal tragedies. And every once in a while we get a glimpse of the suffering. But overall, thank God, our lives are pretty smooth and we have trouble relating. So it's important for us, during this time of year, the rabbi has designated for us 3 weeks a year. 3 weeks a year where we're supposed to sit back and reflect upon the fact that life is not as it should be, that the world is not perfect, that the Jewish people are not in their ideal form. And this is the time to reflect upon that. Starting today, going through Tisha B'Av, really going through Tenth of Av, the day after, we have a period designated in the year to mourn, to reflect, to think. And it's supposed to make us into better people. The rabbis teach us that those who don't mourn over the temple will not be able to rejoice in its rebuilding. Those who do mourn over the temple will rejoice in its rebuilding. Because if we don't have any connection to its loss, we can't connect to its rejuvenation either. So we have to make sure we can connect to the loss of the temple, what it means to us, and through that, we will merit seeing the temple being rebuilt. The other important point, which I think sometimes is missed, is that in the Torah, there's two major sins which occur with the Jews in the desert. The sin of the spies and the sin of the golden calf. And those two sins are the two brackets of this period of the year. Because today, on the 17th of Tammuz, when the Jews worship the golden calf, on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, is when the Jews committed the sin of the spies. And those were the two major sins recorded throughout the Chumash and the Torah. And those are the two sins that define this time of year. You know, the sins happened, not, it wasn't the same exact year those two sins happened. But those sins are what define the time of year that we're in. And those sins are supposed to be, you know, revisited in this time of year. We have to understand that we're still suffering from what our ancestors did in the desert. And we say we're still suffering, it's because we haven't fully fixed what they destroyed. Anytime that we have to continue suffering based on something that our ancestors did, it's because we haven't fully perfected that which they corrupted many, many years ago. Just the rabbi teaches as well, that any generation during which the temple was not rebuilt, they're also guilty of destroying it. Because that means that we have not in any way rectified the sin which our ancestors committed to deserve the temple being destroyed. How do we rectify that sin? The temple could be rebuilt once again. The Mishnah lists in Maseches Tainis, there's five different events which happened on the 17th of Tammuz. So today marks five different events. Number one we mentioned is the sin of the golden calf and the breaking of the first tablets. The day where the world changed, as we mentioned, the world, death re-entered the world, people forget, people are drawn towards evil. That only happened because of the sin, because the tablets were broken. The second event recorded in the Mishnah is that the daily offering, the Karban Tamid, ceased to be given on the 17th of Tammuz during the times of the First Temple. The third event mentioned is that the walls of Jerusalem were breached during the siege in the times of the Second Temple. During the First Temple period, the walls were breached on the ninth day of Tammuz. So it's not a major difference in time, it's a week ago. But we observe the time the walls reached the Second Temple because that was closer to us in history. The fourth thing mentioned in the Mishnah is that a Greek general named Apostemus, he burnt the Torah. It's unclear if he burnt one Torah or all the Torahs he could find. The commentator Tiferes Yisrael writes, it could mean that he burnt the Torah that was written by Ezra. Ezra was the one who brought the Jews back to the Israel in time of the Second Temple. He wrote the most authoritative copy of the Torah that we had, and it could be that it means apostles burned that Sefer Torah, or it could be he just, every single Sefer Torah he could find, he got his hands on, he burned. But we had a wicked Greek general who was out there to destroy our religion. That happened, so he burned these Torah scrolls on the Sefer Tammuz. The fifth thing mentioned in the Mishnah is that somebody, I didn't say who, somebody put an idol into the temple itself. It's a dispute who it was. Some say it was the Jewish king Menashe. Menashe was one of the most wicked, if not the most wicked kings the Jews had in the times of the first temple. He did proliferate idolatry everywhere. So it could be it was him. Some say it refers back to this Greek general Posthumus in the time of the second temple. Either way, on this day, an idol was erected in the Beis HaMikdash, which was a terrible tragedy. Then in God's house, in God's holy temple, we should have an idol in there. So those are the five things mentioned in the Mishnah chapter today. But it marks much more, because, again, this begins a period we're supposed to reflect upon loss and tragedy in Jewish history. We try to usually dwell on God's closeness. We try to dwell on a normal holiday. We think about God's kindness, God's mercy, how close we are to God, how privileged we are. That's usually the focus of Jewish days, of Jewish thought. But we've been in exile now, in Golos, since the year 70, when the second temple was destroyed. We've suffered physically, we've suffered spiritually, both in more recent times, and certainly throughout all the centuries. Whether it be Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazic Jews, whether it be in Europe, whether it be in Sephardic countries, no matter where Jews were, they constantly were suffering and being persecuted. There's also we've had a physical Holocaust and a spiritual Holocaust. You look at American Jewry this very day, and what percentage is actually affiliated and connected, what percentage is assimilated? It's a terrible number. Intermarriage rate is very, very high. And even though physically in America life seems to be, thank God, pretty good, spiritually the Jewish people are suffering very much. And the same amount of Jews that we lost physically in the Holocaust in World War II, we're losing just that many through assimilation. So they aren't being killed, but they're being spiritually lost. Which is, and one can argue which one's worse. Beyond that, we are living in the line of fire right now. The Israeli army is at war. There are many Jews who are scared to walk out of their doors in Israel every single day this past week. We're currently fighting evil in the Gaza Strip. And that's something which hits very close to home. We all have friends and family there. And every single one of these events all traces itself back to the destruction. If the Jews are living in Israel with the temple, observing the Torah and following God's will, that's what happened. Because we have God's divine protection, making sure that we're held up as the lights unto the nations, we're held up as the people who are going to set the role models for the whole world. If not for the destruction and not for our sins, everything happening to this very day would not have happened. We've had expulsions, there have been pogroms, there's been a Holocaust, there's an Inquisition, there's been all sorts of torture, all sorts of persecution which has happened throughout history, and it all starts from that day of Tisha B'Av, almost 2,000 years ago. On Tisha B'Av itself, we say kinos. We say these, we bemoan and lament different things that happen. And the kinos tell us. They tell us that it's not just that we're mourning the destruction, we're mourning everything which happened, because everything is traced to Tisha B'Av. That's what it's all traced to. A close relationship with God, which we had during the times of the temple, was destroyed. And when that relationship is destroyed, so we lose a lot of that kindness of God, we lose God's protection in many ways. We're expelled from our land. There's a story I heard recently. It was told by Rabbi Zev Leff. Rabbi Leff is a great teacher, lives in Israel. He used to be a rabbi in Miami, I think. And Rabbi Leff tells a story. It's a surprising story. But he says he was involved himself. That there was once this girl, and she was suicidal. And people who cared about her came to him as the rabbi and said, "Rabbi, would like you please to maybe make a relationship, get involved with her, help her, because she's trying to commit suicide, and it's really an unhealthy situation." So he said at the time he was a young rabbi, he was kind of new at the job, he was in his 20s at the time. And he said, "I'm not really cut out for this yet, I'm not really experienced, I'm not really trained." So either way, whatever it was, so they involved professionals as well, but they wanted the rabbi involved. So he goes, he speaks with the girl, he finds out her story, and he said, it's an astonishing story. What happened was that her father, I don't know if her mother had died or her father and mother were divorced, but her father was getting remarried. It sounds like his mother had died, is what it sounds like. And her father wanted to get remarried. And he met a woman to marry, But the woman said, I'm going to marry you under one condition. I don't want any teenage kids in the house. I'm not interested in having kids in the house. So it's either me or your daughter. That's what this lady told this man. So the man was very wealthy. He calls him his daughter, and he tells his daughter, he says, here's the keys to luxury condo. There you go. He says, there's a brand new car waiting outside the driveway for you. Here's the keys to the car. He says, here's the credit card. Within reason, do whatever you want with the credit card. He says, and it's nice knowing you. I love you very much. Please take care of yourself. Good riddance. And that's what happened. And she went off on her own. And she had all the money she needed. She was taken care of. But she had no love. She had no one who cared for her. She was just totally left, abandoned. And she became suicidal. She couldn't handle it. So that's the story Rabbi Lev tells. I mean, it's a tragic story. So I don't know the end of the story. Hopefully he was able to heal her. But it's our story with God, because God's always taking care of us. God, we have what we need. But when we're living with the temple, we're living the way the Jews are supposed to be living. So we were living in God's house. We were there in the land of Israel. We had a temple. We were able to perform all the mitzvahs. We were supposed to perform the mitzvahs. We were there as a united people. We felt God's love day in and day out. And that was there. After the destruction, so God promises, I'm never going to destroy the Jewish people. They're always going to remain, and they're going to thrive. And even in exile, thank God, we've had our ups and downs, but we're here, and we're still thriving. We're doing the best we can, and we're thriving. But the relationship, that close relationship we have with God, is gone. We don't feel it. We don't always experience it. We don't always connect. We don't always understand. And that's something which in the time of the temple we had, and now it's gone. It's just like that girl. And we've come so far, we don't even realize we've lost it. That's the problem. The girl knew what she had. She knew that she had a family that loved her, and she lost it. And that hit her very hard. We have come to the point that we don't even realize what it was like to live life with the temple, live life in its ideal sense. So we're not suicidal because we don't know we've lost anything. But the truth is, when you deal and reflect upon the distance we've come from God, then also that should bring us back to closeness. The Jewish calendar is always fascinating to me. The Tisha B'Av prepares you for the month of Elul, which prepares you for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is the time of the year we feel closest to God. We call those the Yomim Narayim, the days of awe. Sukkot is the time, which is the culmination of the whole period, where you walk right back into God's house, in a sense. The Sukkot is the place of God's presence, and you're walking into God's house in Sukkot. So you sit here during the 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av itself, and you reflect upon the fact that God has thrown us out of His land. God's rejected us in many ways. We're very distant. But a few weeks after Tisha B'Av comes the month of Elul. And during the month of Elul, we reflect upon, and we focus on tshuva, on repenting and coming back to God. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, there's a very powerful and intense spiritual experience of closeness with God. And on Sukkot, which ends the whole period, we walk right back into, it's not the Beis HaMikdash, it's not the Holy Temple, but at least it's some semblance of God's presence, God's house in the Sukkah. And it's supposed to, when you reflect upon how far you've gone, that kind of is supposed to lead you right back to God once again. And that's how we're supposed to use this period of the year. We're supposed to mourn and reflect on the tragedies, but we know the tragedies only are there because of our sins. And once we reflect upon those tragedies, we're supposed to then repent and come back to God in a much more intense relationship. But now, like we said, your question?
Yeah. We also have some happy days in there. Also have the happiest day of the year, right in the right after Tisha B'Av.
50th of Av. Yeah,
Tuba. 15th of Av, which is a very happy, one of the most joyous days in the Jewish calendar. And also Yom Kippur, which happen to be days for people to get married and for single people.
Right.
So I think this is part of the picture too.
I think it fits into what I'm saying. I'm saying because the mourning leads you to the joy. That's exactly what we're saying. That once Tisha B'Av hits, you start going uphill once again. Start coming close. That's what I'm pointing out. Once Tisha B'Av comes, I didn't point out Tuba precisely, but the fact that Tisha B'Av comes and you've hit rock bottom and realize how far you are from God, at that point we start going up once again. And the culmination is Yom Kippur and Sukkot. That's the culmination of it all. But once you hit the rock bottom, the only place to go is up. And this is a time where we will focus how far we've gone, how low we've gone, and from there we start going up and up and up. But we are very removed. We don't know what life was like. You know, my sister is telling me, I have a nephew who just went on a program in Israel, right when they started firing rockets, last week.
Canceled.
He went on, they didn't cancel it. He went on the NCSY Kollel program. He's probably 17, my nephew. He just went on this program just last week. I was with my sister yesterday. I said, how's Samuel doing? I said, how's he doing? So she said that, you know, they'd actually moved it. They're originally in Beit Meir, which is sort of within rocket range of Gaza. They're like, that's between Jerusalem and Beit Shemesh. So they moved him further north, so he'd be out of rocket range from Gaza. Little they know that they're going to start shooting from the north also. But
did start shooting?
A little bit. Not much, a little bit. There were a few rockets, I think, from Syria, from Lebanon. So he's up in the Golan Heights now. But I said to her, like, you know, how's he doing? He said, you know, like, he's a teenage boy. The teenagers don't really live in reality, you know? Like, these things don't really affect them so much. And, you know, and it's true. Like, we know what it's like for a teenage kid. They don't really live in reality. And, you know, the things happening around them don't really faze them in any way. But that's how we live also, because we're not living in reality. Because we think life is smooth. We think life is going as it should be. And we don't realize that there was a different world out there. There was a time of greatness, a time of great spiritual heights, a time of closeness to God, a time of Jewish unity, a time where the Shekhinah of God's presence rested upon within us daily. And we don't understand what it means. You know, for us, you know, we live a child's version of the world. You know, this is all play, because we don't know what the real version is like. And we don't have any access to it. We just can't relate to it. We don't know, we have no idea. So it's hard to know what we're even talking about. It's something which is, you know, because we never experienced it. I've said over many times in the past, I'm not going to say it again, the metaphor of the artist who went colorblind. Anyone remembers that from previous years? But just, you know, I won't say the long metaphor, but an artist who goes colorblind, his whole world is shot. Because he lives to live in a world of color, and I live in a world of darkness, of blacks and whites. He can't see anything else anymore. But even go back 100 years ago, they could relate more to the suffering and the tragedies. You know, we can relate to the tragedy. And thank God, we're happy to live a smooth life, and we don't have to relate to tragedies in that sense. But God sends reminders to us. God makes sure that we know. Because we have to realize that we're still living in exile, we're still living distant from God, and it's all one big exile. I mean, we can't say, well, America's different. Now, that was in Europe, but America's different. That was in Spain, but America's different. That was in Poland, America's different. We can't say that. Because why? Because as soon as God threw us out of his land, after the structure of the second temple, everything comes together. And we can never think that, you know, we're in a different time now. And, you know, thank God as you continue, everything should be peaceful, and we should never experience tragedies like our ancestors had to experience. But we can't distance ourselves from it and remove ourselves from the tragedy and think that that's not us anymore. Because we're still Jews living in exile, we're still Jews who have not been redeemed by God, we have no Mashiach, we have no temple, we have no unity, we have Jews who are assimilating left and right, and we have Jews who are being persecuted. There is anti-Semitism. There was just, I think, a stabbing last week in France, then we have the Jews in Israel. I mean, it's not something which is beyond us. So, and I don't want to be...
It's too negative. I mean, there's more Jews studying Torah now today than ever before. I mean, there's some positive points in there, too.
You know, there's a time to reflect on negative, time to reflect on the positive. That's what I'm saying. This is a time to reflect on the negative. All year we reflect on the positive. This is a time of year where we're supposed to reflect on the negative. You know, we're supposed to realize that we are crippled. You know, and as many achievements as we have, this is the time of year to focus on the fact that there's a lot lost. That's why we sit on the floor on Tisha B'Av, and we say the kinos, and we're supposed to cry, and understand that, you know, we're lacking so much.
Yeah. God gives you reminders. What kind of reminders?
I think it's certainly a reminder. You know, I think that Jews, someone else asked me, they said, you know, we now have Jewish control over Israel. We have Jerusalem back. We have the Western Wall. Why are we still saying every year, next year in Jerusalem? Why are we still mourning over the temple? Why are we still praying that God should restore us to Jerusalem? We have it. So they're missing the boat, obviously, because even though we might have the piece of the land, we don't have the Jews there. We don't have the Torah observance there. We don't have a temple. We don't have Jewish leaders of the caliber that we need. There's a lot missing. But on the other hand, I think that God makes that clear to us. The fact that the minute the Jews took back the land of Israel, they have been subject to wars and terrorism and rocket fire and bombs day in and day out. God's reminding us that don't think that you've made it. Just because I gave you back the land, don't think that you've made it. There's a long way to go still. And we hope that it's not a short way to go, not a long way to go. But I think God's constant, I think these are reminders to us. It's happened, you know, it's past few times that we've had these wars, we'll call them in Israel, it hasn't this time of year, it's been in the summer. And I think, you know, God's sending us a very powerful message that this is the time of destruction. This is the time where I threw you out of the land, and I gave you the land back. You're welcome to come back in the land, but you have to realize that you still have to repent. You have to observe Torah properly, and then you'll be able to make it to the finish line. Then you'll get the land back as it should be. But right now, I'm giving you reminders day in and day out that, you know, you're not free in the land. There are people out there who still want to throw you out of the land, people who want to kill you, and that's supposed to teach us. That's a daily occurrence for a couple minutes, and it goes away. And when he wants to teach us, so that you're still Jews in exile, and even though you're standing in the Holy Land, you're still Jews in exile, because it's not, the land has not reached perfection quite yet. Again, we are being very negative. On the other hand, this period is time is an opportunity for spiritual growth. You know, we never, as Jews, everything's supposed to be an inspiration, a springboard for us to grow. You can't take any period of the year, any day of the year, and say, this is a day we're supposed to just be depressed. Even on Tisha B'Av, the rabbis call Tisha B'Av a moed. They refer to it as a holiday, Tisha B'Av. And we skip Tachanun prayer. Tachanun is a prayer which you skip on happy days. You skip it on Tisha B'Av. There's an aspect of Tisha B'Av which is an aspect of joy. There was two little angels, cherubs, on top of the Holy Ark, of the Aron Kodesh in the Beis HaMikdash. Those two angels would reflect God's feelings towards us. The Gemara tells us that when God was on good terms with us, the two angels would look at one another and embrace. When we were sinning, they would turn away. But the Talmud says that on the day of the destruction of the temple, the two are embracing. The two angels are embracing. And we would think that's very strange, because that's the day of God's greatest wrath against his people. The day our temple was destroyed, he threw us out of the land. That's probably the most depressing and tragic day in Jewish history. But God's telling you, no, that this is a time where I'm showing you my love. Like a parent disciplining a child. You don't say that parent hates the child. You say that parent loves the child. That's why I discipline the child.
Where did you say they would sit ordinarily? They would sit, the two angels?
So there's two angels that were on top of the ark.
Of the ark.
In the temple, in the Holy of Holies. So it happens to be that, just to be exact, it seems to be that these angels were discussing during the destruction of the second temple were actually not the ones on the ark, but actually the ones on the curtain of the temple. The ark had angels, but the ark was already hidden away in the first temple period. There was no ark in the second temple. So when the Talmud says that in the second temple the angels turned away, those referring to angels actually painted on the, they were embroidered on the curtains there, not actually on the ark. But in the first temple, it was the ones on the ark that were embracing one another. But God's telling us an important message, that you have to realize that everything which happened is a sign of love. We don't always feel the love. We don't say how it's a sign of love, but it's a sign of love. Like this girl. This girl would have been thrilled had her father cared enough to even discipline her. Right? The father just rejected her. We don't want to be rejected. We want God to bring us back on the right path, to send us in the right direction once again. That's what we want. So discipline is a good thing. You know, when you watch a parent and a child, you never think, what a terrible, sometimes we do, unfortunately, but hopefully the parent's looking out for the best of the child. You say, you know, you don't say that that's a terrible parent or they're disciplining a child, you say that's a good thing, that kid needs it. So when we look at God disappointing us, that's to be the same attitude, that we needed it. That's what we need. It's a time that God's reaching out to us. It's a moed. It's a holiday. It's a holiday in the fact that a holiday is a time where you rendezvous with God. We touch God on a holiday. There's a closest to God. Tisha B'Av is also a moed. The word moed, different sources point out, comes from the word vad, which is a meeting place. It's a meeting time. I call it a rendezvous point. So Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, those are rendezvous points with God. But those are rendezvous points that usually deal with God's kindness, God's love, the blessings we got from God, God's miracles. Tisha B'Av is also a rendezvous with God, but it's a rendezvous in a different way. It's God's Midas HaDin, God's actual justice, which is expressing itself on Tisha B'Av, but it's also a rendezvous with God. We're also connecting with God on Tisha B'Av. It's a moed. Hasidic thought even points out that, you know, when the king's in his palace, it's very hard to access the king. But when the king's out traveling, so then you can walk up to his wagon and you can shake his hand and talk to the king when he's out traveling. So, as it were, you know, God, when he's in his palace, he's in the Holy Temple, so he's harder to access in some ways. But when God's out there with us, the sources we'll talk about a little bit later, sources point out that when Jews went to exile, God's presence came with us to exile. So God's with us too. God's with us in our suffering. So in some ways, it's actually easier to connect to God in exile because he's not behind the walls of the palace. He's out there. Now, I hate to use such a metaphor, but you know, a politician on the campaign trail, which is totally a terrible metaphor, but that's when you can actually go over and talk to them and speak to them and they smile and they give you a pat on the back and you tell them what you think. No, they couldn't care less what you think, but you tell them what they think. Once he's elected and he's sitting there in his office on Capitol Hill, they couldn't care less what you say. So again, it's a terrible analogy to God, but the point is that sometimes when the king is out and out and about and traveling, there's an excess which is there, which you don't have when the king's in his palace. So this time of year, where we focus on the fact that God's not in his palace, God is out there traveling. God is in exile with us. In a certain sense, you can connect to God in a way which you couldn't connect with when you're sitting there in the palace. This time of year helps us reflect on our former glory, and also on the tragedies as well. Because if we don't understand the glory, we don't understand the tragedies. So we have to be able to envision in our minds, what was it like in those days? What are we missing? What would it be like if all the Jews lived in the land of Israel, in unity, with a central point of worship in the Holy Temple, with Jewish leaders and Jewish kings and Jewish courts resolving our issues? What would life be like? And that's just the most basic part of it all. But if we just imagine that, that's one step towards understanding what life is like in the time of the Temple. So what I'll do, we have little time today, and then we'll continue, God willing, next week. I want to discuss, we began last year the book of Echa, the book of Lamentations. Megillas Echa is what we read on Tisha B'Av. We read Tisha B'Av at night. It was written by...
Sorry. Thank you very much.
Sure. It was written by Jeremiah the prophet, Yirmiyahu HaNavi. He is the one who witnessed the destruction of the temple. He is the one who was the guide and leader of the Jews during that time. And he recorded his, through prophecy, he recorded his reflections in Megillas Echa. The book of Echa is written about the destruction of the first temple, where we still had prophecy, and where Jeremiah lived. But it's prophetic in that it predicts that which occurs during the second temple as well. The book of Echa is, again, helps us reflect upon the tragedies and the glory of the time of the Jews living in Jerusalem and in Israel during the time of the temple. The book, most of the chapters in the book, most of the chapters in the book are written in the form of the Aleph Beis, in an alphabetical order. Each verse is the next letter in the alphabet. And the rabbis say it's because the Jews, they violated the Torah, which is given with the letters of the Aleph Beis. So therefore, the book which bemoans the tragedy is written in that form as well. But it's also a sign to us that the destruction was an all-encompassing destruction. Like we say, it was from A to Z. You know, everything was included. Just like you have, you know, we say in English, I had everything from A to Z. I mean, I had everything. It was all-encompassing. So too, the sinning and the destruction were all-encompassing. And that's what another understanding of the book written in the form of the Hebrew alphabet. I believe last year we went through the first chapter of Echa together, so I think we'll start this year with the second chapter. So there are... What?
Yeah.
We definitely did it for a few weeks. Could be somewhere, you know, but we did it a few weeks last year. 1274, thank you.
I get all these emails that, you know, the three boys were killed and how much opposition they created. And I think that's like the opposite of, you know, I just wonder if that's what that would lead us into.
Right. I mean, everything's a step. You know, sometimes you need a tragedy to bring people together, you know? And it could be if we learn from that, then we don't need a tragedy for it. We just learn to be united. That'd be the best. And so, for those who want to hear about what we did about the first chapter, the classes are online on torahdownloads.com. I think we have them up there from last year.
Sorry, where is it?
torahdownloads.com. torahdownloads.com. So I think whatever we did last year is up there on torahdownloads.com. And I'm reasonably sure we made it through the first chapter, if not most of it. So I think we'll start this year in the second chapter. So in a few minutes, we'll get started, and next week we'll try to do some more. So let's do the book of Echa. It's a lot of Yirmiyah's personal experiences. It's his reflections upon the Jewish people. It's about the suffering. It's about the greatness. It's about God's wrath. He really points out a lot of different reflections that have occurred during the times of the destruction. So we'll read it in the English just to make it easier for everyone here, but I always say you lose a lot in translation. We'll have to look back at the Hebrew sometimes just to get the main point. So the second chapter, one thing I will introduce again, we introduced it last year, but the word Echa itself is a fascinating word. The word Echa, which the Archbold translation is alas, which I don't think means that much to us, alas. But the word Echa seems to stem from the Hebrew word Ech. How? How could it be? How could such a thing be? And it's a question which resonates with us and should knock us in the head and tell us, how could this happen? How could we let such a terrible thing happen? And it's our fault. It's because of our sins, because of our disobedience to God. That's why it all happened. That's Echa. How could it be? And the book is called Echa. And I believe 3 out of the 5 chapters begin with the word Echa. They do 4 of them. But three out of five, give the word Eicha. And that's what that word means. The rabbis even point out the fact that the word Eicha is found used a few different places throughout the Tanakh. And each one is kind of a preliminary thought leading up to the destruction. Because Moshe himself says, in Parshas Devarim, he says, Eicha asal avadi torchachem masachem rivchem, I think is what the verse says. How could it be, Eicha, how could it be that I can handle and bear myself all of the fighting amongst the Jews? This is already in the desert. This was, the Jews in the desert, this first 40 years. And Moshe was already complaining about the Jews being disobedient, having disputes amongst each other. And he uses the word Eicha. And what he's doing, it's a precursor to what's going to happen. Because when Jews fight, that's the beginning of the end. The prophet Isaiah, he says, Eicha ha'isa lazona kirin amana. How could it be, Eicha, how could it be that the faithful city of Jerusalem became a zona, became like a prostitute? You used to be loyal to God, you used to be faithful to God, and suddenly the whole city has rejected God and gone and done their own thing. And that's the next step towards the destruction. And finally, Jeremiah, in the book of Eicha, he begins the book, Eicha shvav adad. How could it be that the city dwells alone in solitude? The ear, Rabbah Siyam, the city that used to be full of the multitudes of people, is now like a widow. The city is lamenting, the city cries. And that's the third step of Eicha. And the term itself is alluded to even in the original sin of Adam and Chava and Adam and Eve. Because after Adam and Chava sin, God comes to them and he says to Adam, Ayeka, where are you? And it's the same exact letters as the word Eicha. Same letters, Ayeka, same Aleph Yud Kaf Hei.
God said that to
Adam. Where are you? Because after Adam sinned, Adam went to hide from God. And God came and said, Adam, where are you? Trying to urge Adam to repent, is what Rashi tells us. But it's the same exact letters as Eicha, because if the human being has the ability to hide from God, so then it's just a slippery slope until the temple is destroyed. And it all began with the original sin of Adam and Eve. That's where it began.
Excuse my ignorance on this question, but yeah. God knows where you are all the time, right? So God was only testing Adam to come out because God knew where he was hiding.
Exactly. Rashi explains that God was trying to get Adam to come out and say, here I am, and I'm sorry for what I did. He wanted him to repent and confess.
We have Abraham. When God asks him, calls Abraham, he says, here I am.
That's Abraham. Yeah, right, exactly. That's a good contrast, right. Others say, Hineni, I'm ready for you, God. Here I am, I'm ready to go. Right, that's a very good contrast. But Adam was hiding. And then eventually when Adam came out, he said, well, God, this woman you gave to me, she enticed me to sin, and like it was the snake's fault, and he had all excuses in the book. But God already saw at that point, the human being has the ability to hide and deny and ignore God. So then, again, it's a natural progression until we reached the end of the book of Eicha. It took a few thousand years, but we got there, unfortunately. So that's the word Eicha itself. So let's just start with the first verse in chapter 2, page 1274, and I think we'll start the rest of it next week. It says, alas, or Eicha, how could it be? The Lord in his anger has clouded the daughter of Zion. He cast down from heaven to earth the glory of Israel. He did not remember his footstool on the day of his wrath. Let's understand a few of these points. The Hebrew term used, Eicha Ya'iv Be'apo. Ya'iv is a term talking about a cloud. How could God in his wrath has clouded the daughter of Zion? So what's the connotation of the cloud, of the darkness, is that there's a separation being made. We discussed, I guess it was a few weeks ago, that God's compared to the sun. And God shines upon the world. God provides for us our life, our warmth. God's compared to the sun. So a cloud doesn't affect the sun. The cloud just blocks us from experiencing the sun. So God says, the prophet says, Jeremiah says, that God has clouded the earth. That now the earth is going to be clouded. And the fascinating thing is that the Gemara even says, halachically, that there's a blessing that we're supposed to say on... I think this is on a clear, I'm trying to remember the Gemara exactly, I think on a clear day, and on a 100% clear day, there's a blessing to be said. However, the Talmud says we don't say that blessing anymore. Why? Because ever since the temple was destroyed, there's never a clear day. So we look outside and we see a clear day, it's a blue sky. But we don't realize there's, even physically, there's something in the sky which is not supposed to be there. Even the sky looked different in those days. And that's what the Talmud says. So, again, we're talking both in spiritual and physical terms, but spiritually there's a cloud, there's a separation, there's a barrier between us and God. And that's lost. That connection, the clarity we had is lost now. That's this idea of Ya'iv Be'apo. There's this clouding, God's clouded us. And then it says, he cast down from heaven to earth the glory of Israel. The rabbis point out, from heaven to earth signifies from the highest of heights to the lowest of lows. it says Mi'igra Rama, from the highest roof of a Bira Mikvah to the depths of a pit. That's how it's gone. It was God thrust us down from the heights all the way down to nothingness. There's a one of the keynotes we recite on Tisha B'Av. It contrasts our greatest moment to our lowest moment. It contrasts B'tzeisi Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, to B'tzeisi Mitzrayim, leaving Jerusalem. It talks about the glory of the Jews with Moshe and Aaron and the miracles, the clouds of glory, leaving Egypt with pride and excitement, and then the depression of the Jews leaving Jerusalem, being led out by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, being led out by the Romans, being led out in mourning and death and blood and destruction. And that's exactly what the prophet's describing. The Jews had a point where they were bishamayim. They were at the heights. They were so high up. And then there's a point where they were the lowest of the low. The term used here is that God did not remember his footstool on the day of his wrath. What is God's footstool? So we talk about Shemayim Kisi. God, again, it's an analogy, but God says that the heavens are my chair, V'aretz Adom Raglai, and the earth is my footstool. Which in a deeper sense means that there's a place where God connects with the earth. You know, God has his stature up in the spiritual worlds, but God does connect with the earth in some places, which is where, you know, what we call God's footstool. God's feet touch the earth. Again, this is all metaphor, obviously, nothing physical that we're describing. But, and what was that place where God most powerfully and intensely touched the earth? That was the Beis Hamikdash. That was the Holy Temple. And God, even though God wants to connect to our world, and God had a place where he connected with our world in a very intense way, God did not remember his footstool on the day of destruction, the day of wrath. God said, I don't care about my desires of having a place to think of this world. My people need to be punished, they need to be disciplined, and I have to forget my own desires right now of connecting with this world and destroy the Holy Temple. There's two other points, I'm a little late. If anyone needs to go, you're welcome to go, but there's two other points on this verse. It says that God has cast from the heavens to the earth Tiferes Yisrael, the pride of Israel. The glory of Israel is translated, or the pride. The pride of Israel, you can understand, is what it means, the pride to be Jews. We should be proud of who we are, proud that we're God's chosen people, we're given a special mission, we have the Torah, and our pride as Jews is also lost. Our pride very much was based, I assume, on our connection with God. We have the temple, it's based on our unity in the land of Israel, it's based on the miracles we experienced day in and day out during those days. And at this point, our pride is lost, been cast down into the pit of destruction. Now we don't always stand up for ourselves. We don't stand up for what we believe in all the time. We don't walk around as proud Jews all the time. We try to excuse our behavior. We're apologetic for what we do. We all feel it at times, and we've lost our tiferes, that pride. We should be walking around with a crown on our heads that we are God's great people, and we should walk around so proud of who we are and what we do. But yet. Our pride is lost. You know, you'll see that many religious Jews walk around with their tzitzis hanging out. So the Chofetz Chaim explains why is it such an important thing. So again, halachically, it's a requirement, but not a requirement halachically. But the Chofetz Chaim says, if you are given, you know, the king's special jewelry, wouldn't you want to show it to everybody? Wouldn't you want everyone to know that, you know, the king loves you, and the king gave you his special ring, his special necklace. He gave you a special suit to wear. You want to show everybody. You'd be so proud of it. It says when a person walks around and they're displaying they're Jewish, you know, there's a sense like the yarmulke, whatever. You walk around and everyone knows you're Jewish. It should be filled with pride because we're so happy about who we are and what we do. But yet, at the destruction, our pride is lost. It's difficult for us. And, you know, we don't always walk around so proud. And a lot of times we are apologetic for our actions because that's part of being in exile. We're amongst a culture which doesn't always support what we do. We're a minority. We're a very small minority. And we often are not so proud. We can't walk around. A lot of times we do try to do things in secret. We try to hide our identity. But it's important to understand that part of what, that's a loss. It's something that we had and we've lost. One other point made about this verse, and we'll end with this, is that some understand the idea of Tiferes Yisrael, the glory of Israel, refers to God's presence, the Shekhinah. God's divine presence. And it's saying that God's divine presence was cast from the heavens to the earth. So a commentary called the Pal Gemayim, written by the famous Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, who was known for his great halachic work in his Nesivos HaMishpat, but he says that this verse is actually a positive thing, because it's showing that God's presence came with us into exile. When Jacob first went to Egypt, So God tells him, Anochi Erdim Chametz Yisrael, I'm going to go down with you to Egypt as well. And I'm going to bring you out of Egypt, God says. This was long before the 10 plagues and the Jewish slavery. But God tells Jacob, I'm going to go with you to Egypt. I'm going to bring you out of Egypt. So the rabbis point out, because we have something called the Shechina Begalusa. God goes into exile with us. And there's always a special protection and love of God in exile, even though we don't really see it. And it's hidden. But God's always there for us. He's always there taking care of us. He might be hiding behind the scenes. But Hashem's always there with us, making sure that things go as they need to go. So this verse, as terrible as it sounds, that God cast out from heaven to earth the glory of Israel. But the Palgemayim, this commentary explains that it's God casting His own presence to be with us in the exile. Even in the most tragic of times, God is there. And we don't really see Him. I'll say, just we've said this analogy before, but I'll mention it one more time. It's one of my favorite analogies. You have this idea of a parent watching a child playing out in the yard. If the parent looks through the window, the child sees the parent sees the child. If the parent peeks through a little crack, so the parent's watching the kid, but the kid can't see the parent. So sometimes God looks at us through windows, and we see God looking right at us. And we look back, and we see God waving, hi, and we say thank you, and we see God's watching us, we see His protection, and that's great. But other times, God's still watching us, but He's peering through cracks. So we look back at the house, we don't see anything. We think that the mother's up, you know, taking a nap or something. But really, she's there, peeking right through the little crack in the door, watching her child, protecting her child, and God oftentimes peeks through cracks. But doesn't mean He's not there. So when we're in exile, God's there with us, the Shekhinah's there with us, there's still God's presence there in exile with us, but He's not always visible. We can't always see the miracles and see the protection. He's always there, peeking through the cracks, protecting us. So even though it seems to be a very tragic verse, this first verse here in chapter 2 of Eicha, there is a positive slant given to it, which is that the Shekhinah comes with us into Galus and protects us when we're in exile. And from that, God says, I will then bring you out of exile back to the Holy Land as things should be. Okay, so we got into the second chapter. We'll stop here. Next week, I will work on this.